and welcome to Here We Stand. I am your regular host, Kevin Andy, Eagle Strong Voice. We're carrying it on, humanity's oldest struggle for dignity and liberty against state tyranny. We're here today, as every Sunday, to carry on the struggle as the voice of the resistance and the Republic of Kanata. And it's been said that one shining example is better than a million words. And I'm honored today to have with me Paul Kaliba, who is an embodiment of that principle. You know, many people over the last half century nearly that I've been doing this kind of work, I haven't met a hell of a lot of people who embody the principle of a true leader, which is two things, makes them different than just a simple talker. There's two things that you need to be a genuine leader to inspire people. You have to lead by example through actions and not words. And you have to pay up personally and not be afraid to pay up personally. Well, this last month, Paul has demonstrated that. Paul Kaliba is going to join us in 1 minute. He's an organizer for the Republic in Central Ontario. And on January 8th, he was abducted illegally, kidnapped really, and at gunpoint, taken to Central East Correctional Center in Lindsay, Ontario, held there for 3 weeks, tortured, abused in every way possible, clearly targeted for his role as an organizer, very outspoken organizer for common law, for liberty, for the Republic of Kanata. And we are going to wait on our announcements till the end of the show because it's so important that we give as much time as possible for Paul to share with us how we can fight and win in these situations. You know, fear is something that's in front of us all the time. I think people like Paul and I realize that the only way we overcome fear is by facing it directly through our actions. And I hope you're all inspired today by what you hear. Paul, welcome to the show.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me on.
It's an honor, brother. I consider you a brother in arms, as somebody who is willing to not only be kind of, you're an expert in a lot of this, you know, coming to know you. You know a lot. And your words are very bold and good, but you do more than talk, and that's the difference between you and the internet word warrior, you know. And I hope that people appreciate that today when we're speaking. And the one other thing I want to just mention for the listeners, what you're going to hear today is a description of a crime against humanity, because international law considers that when one nation abducts the citizens of another nation, that is a war crime. And Paul Kaliba, as a sworn citizen of the Republic, was really what happened to him is he underwent rendition, illegal rendition. And we intend to hold those responsible accountable for these things. But Paul, let me just ask you, first of all, to give a description of who you are and really what led up to this. And then we'll get into the time in prison and what you experienced there.
Sure. Yeah, I'll just give a little background. You know, a few years ago, you know, I didn't really know much about human rights or, you know, the Constitution of Canada or common law. It was just, I had, you know, some personal issues of my own. The first one was, you know, I just got into a little dispute with a corporation called MPAC, Municipal Property Assessment Corporation, in regards to the assessment of my property, and things just sort of went from there. And when I really started to, you know, feel something was wrong, when, you know, agents of this corporation were, you know, threatening entrance into my home, my dwelling, using, you know, some sort of legislation and enactments, and it just didn't feel right. You know, growing up in this land and being taught, you know, from birth that we are, you know, the true north, strong and free, and we have liberty, and I'm being, you know, threatened by people I've never met before, you know, who work for, you know, this service corporation, a Crown service corporation, that they can force entry into my home by law. And, you know, it just didn't sit well with me. And that's where, you know, the journey sort of began. And then another one, you know, soon after that was just another traffic ticket where I felt a police officer had really tried to throw the book at me. And, you know, I just put my foot down. I said, I'm gonna fight these any way I can. And I knew nothing about rights. And until, and exactly at that same time, a friend of mine had sent me a video of an individual in Canada who was fighting also things like property tax and income tax, and that sort of led me down the road of, you know, I better start reading up on my rights in Canada and start learning about them and then exercising them. So that's for me where it really started. I didn't really think too much of it. I just thought that I could gain some knowledge and have a, and put up a good fight in one of their courts. And then it
let
just,
me ask you,
the rabbit hole just started to go from there, you know?
Right. Let me ask you what happened that led you to come along the Republic of Canada and getting involved with your own assembly.
Yeah, so with these, you know, two fights, one with the MPAC and filing, you know, a court matter with the ARB, Arbitration Review Board, and then the other one trying to fight a traffic ticket in you know, traffic court. I started to realize that these courts were not interested in upholding my rights as a human being. And there was something very fishy going on with the system. And it just started to take me down a road of, you know, there's some conspiring going on here against our rights. And I didn't feel I was going to be getting any sort of remedy in their courts anymore. I mean, they just kept, I mean, it was almost like for a minor traffic ticket, I was going to almost have to take it to the Supreme Court of Canada and, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars later. And, it, you know, it just didn't seem viable. It seemed like it was intentional that the system was set up that way. And a friend of mine also had, you know, sent me a link to the Republic of Canada. And I just started reading a little bit on the website. It took a few weeks before I was able to reach you. But, you know, everything made sense about it to me that, you know, we could create our own assembly and our own courts and our own justice system, and one that is based upon actual natural law and not, you know, these rules and statutes and regulations that are being spit out of, you know, Parliament in a very tyrannical way. So that's basically how, you know, I came across, you know, the Republic of Canada. And then, you know, after we had a few meetings and what the next steps were, we gathered, you know, people in our local area with contacts that you sent me. And we started to gather and assemble. And we created our own Canadario Assembly on December 9th of 2020. We have a charter that we all signed. And it basically states what we stand for.
Do you want to sum up a little bit about what that is in just a few sentences? What are the principles you're standing on in the assembly?
Well, we're basically about protecting families and communities, you know, from any trespasses against us. You know, we're mm-hmm. about maintaining peace and justice, and we want to uphold, you know, the natural law, the common law, and defend ourselves and our liberties against any kind of tyrannical powers that we feel are being pressed on us, which is what we feel right now from the Canadian government and Crown authority. If we don't stand up for ourselves, they're surely not going to. So this is, you know, the first step
right
into fighting back.
Yeah, it was pretty obvious to me that just the way everything played out, that you were definitely on their radar screen, and you were being targeted because of that involvement. So maybe you could lead us through exactly what happened, Paul. How did they grab you? Just the incident that led to your imprisonment.
Sure, yeah, definitely. Before the assembly, so I had in 2019, in I think June of 2019, it was one of the first Highway Traffic Act, Ontario Highway Traffic Act offenses that I stood up against when I was pulled over by an officer on a rural road in North Oshawa. And it was the first time that I had responded and stood up for and exercised my rights by explaining to the officer that I was not required to provide him with a driver's license, and I was not required to identify as per my rights. The Highway Traffic Act was passed through legislation under Trade and Commerce, Section 91(2) of the Constitution, and I wasn't utilizing my vehicle for that purpose. And the response I got from the officer was, it was vicious. It was, in my view, psychotic. And he just snapped and, you know, reached in my vehicle and opened the door and physically and violently removed me and placed me under arrest. I asked him what the charges were. He said they were, you know, failure to identify Section 33(3) of the Ontario Highway Traffic Act. And I said to him, look, I'll identify under duress and protest and let's, you know, go on our way. And no, he was not having it. And he continued to, you know, place me in the back of his cruiser. And more officers arrived on the scene. And by the end of it, I was charged with 13 charges, a number from the Criminal Code of Canada, in terms of like resisting arrest and obstructing a peace officer and assaulting a police officer. They really tried to charge me with everything under the sun. Meanwhile, none of that was true, and there is actually no evidence to back it up. I was actually recording the whole matter on my cell phone. Unfortunately, my cell phone was unlocked, and when a police officer had cuffed me and put me in the back of the vehicle, he had gone into my vehicle unlawfully and deleted the video on my phone, and so that evidence was destroyed.
Right.
That's a crime in itself. But yeah, then
so tell us.
You know, I tried for 12 days while I was in unlawful detention to file a writ of habeas corpus, which is under 10C of the Canadian Charter. And I was unable to, for 12 days, acquire resources while in custody to file this writ. So after 12 days, I had to accept a bail under duress and protest and began going through the legal process that they were trying to push me down. So this has been going on since
This was the first arrest. I just want to clarify to the listeners, this was your first arrest, and how did this lead to the second incident, the big one that happened on January 8th?
Right, so after that first arrest, once I was let out, I still filed the writ of habeas corpus in a superior court, and it was dismissed on the grounds that I was not in forcible confinement. So I had filed an appeal within 30 days with the Ontario Court of Appeals. And while that was going on, because that matter was somewhat separate from their legal prosecution of my legal person, they were still trying to continue to prosecute me in their fictitious world. And then the COVID pandemic hit and the courts were all shut down. I could not get a hearing in the Ontario Court of Appeals. The Ontario Court of Justice was still trying to move forward and prosecute me. So they shut down a court that I was seeking a remedy of for the violation of my human rights and the unlawful arrest and the whole process. And they were still trying to prosecute my legal person. So what ended up happening is, you know, I sent a notice to the court and to the Crown that I was not consenting to any phone or video appearances. And, they didn't accept that, and they filed a fraudulent warrant for my arrest that was unendorsed and that could only be executed while I was in a motor vehicle. And they needed the photo on my driver's license with the legal name in order to arrest me. So I had police officers waiting outside of my house the day before, and they were unable to come up to my door and execute the warrant. They were literally waiting for me to get in my vehicle. So, I mean, you'd think that would be a little red flag on the fact that the warrant is fraudulent to begin with. But while I got in the vehicle on the next morning, you know, within a matter of minutes, there was no cops around me. But then within a matter of minutes, there was about five or six or seven police cars that surrounded my vehicle. And the police exited with guns drawn and proceeded to arrest me. In a very violent and physical manner.
And did they at any point say what you were being charged with?
They claim there's a warrant out for my arrest for failure to appear. So failure to call in, to phone in to the Ontario Court of Justice. And this is after, you know, multiple communication with the courts and even advice from lawyers that I did not have to call in to the court without my consent.
You were asking for due process. You wanted to appear in front of a judge in a regular court, and they wanted you to be involved in a fraudulent process, and you said no, and that seemed to be the issue.
Yeah, exactly. And they didn't know what else to do. So, of course, when they're running out of options, they go and opt for the violent option and the forcible confinement one. So it was really, kind of a shock in a way. I didn't think that the Ontario government and the Durham police could stoop to such, low levels. But, I'm not surprised anymore. And through this experience, it has definitely, affected my trust with the current law enforcement.
Tell us what happened when you got to the prison. I mean, people know some of the general details of the extent to which you were strip searched, pepper sprayed, denied food and water, all of this. But tell us kind of in an overview what happened over the following weeks.
So, yeah, so on the Friday, January 8th, when I was first arrested, I was, which was also, again, video recorded on my phone. And I'll explain what happened with my phone later on. But I was taken to 17 Division in downtown Oshawa, where I spoke with a lawyer that I hadn't retained, but, he's sort of a friend of mine, and he had done some work on my, helped me out with the habeas corpus application. I asked him to file an immediate habeas corpus when I had contacted him, and he said he was in trial all day, he wasn't going to be able to do that, but he advised just speak with the judge and tell them that you want a habeas corpus hearing in person and that you were not consenting to any phone or video hearings. So later in the afternoon, around 4 o'clock, a court officer, I believe her name was Officer Hoover, she had brought the a cell phone into my cell, and she had identified me as Paul Kaliba to the judge, and she said I was now in court. And I basically, repeated the words that I was given from the lawyer and added a few things. I mean, usually generally when I start off a court appearance, it's, who are you and what court is this and what law are you acting under on the bench and what's the jurisdiction of the court? They never want to answer those questions, and for obvious reasons. But you know, I basically just said I don't consent to the jurisdiction. I don't consent to video and phone hearing. And I want to file an immediate habeas corpus and have a habeas corpus hearing. She just ignored my words and proceeded with a preliminary hearing with the Crown. It took about 5 minutes, and then they issued a remand order for failure to appear. They said that Mr. Kaliba had failed to appear in the court, and so Mr. Kaliba was being remanded till Monday. So after the court was finished, I looked at the officer, and I said, well, you put me in court. You identified me. So how did I fail to appear in court? You can't apply this order to me because I'm clearly not Mr. Kaliba. I mean, Mr. Kaliba is a fictitious entity and I'm a living human being and I was in court. You witnessed it. But the police, they just kind of give you a blank face and they just go through the process. And I was sent to the Central East Correctional Center that evening. When I approached the Central East Correctional Center, the care and custody and liability is switching hands from now the Durham police to the correctional facility. So they're required for you to identify yourself before you come in the facility. This time around, which was different from the last time, I just did not identify myself at all. And I said I wasn't answering any questions. And I was immediately labeled a road pirate, a new term I heard. But they put me in a special cell that was about 10 yards from the front entrance. And it was called a dry cell. And, the interesting thing about the dry cell is that they weren't able to touch me or search me or anything, which was different from the last time I had been processed in that jail. I seemed to have more rights in that cell. They required my consent on a lot of things. I wasn't given anything like a toothbrush or you know, access to a shower or access to a phone or paper or pencil. As they stated, they were just required to treat me humanely, and that was it. And that's where I remained from Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday night. And through those, you know, days and nights, there was a lot of psychological, you know, warfare that was going on between me and all the correctional officers and staff sergeants and all these people who were swarming around the dry cell. It just seemed.
What kind of things?
Yeah, go ahead.
What kind of things did they do to you?
Well, at first, when I was in the dry cell, it seemed like they were doing everything in their power to coerce me to come out of the dry cell and go through their process. You know, identify myself and you know, get checked in and take a photo and, you know, get your bracelet with a number on it. But nothing, I was not going to do anything. I had my pants on still, so I was pretty much like, I must be doing something right, because they're not able to forcefully remove my clothes or you know, inject me with a vaccine or, you know, take my photo. So I just thought, this is the safest place to be right now, and nothing is going to pull me out of here. So I decided to stay in there. I was very vocal. I mean, you know, because you can get pretty bored just hanging out in a dry cell for the whole weekend. So, you know, I was very vocal about, you know, that the contract that they came in with has nothing to do with me. It's not my name on there. You know, the police sent over this one piece of paper with an order on it. It just had a name on it. There was no fingerprint recognition. There was no mugshot. There was no way that this correctional center was able to identify me as the name on that piece of paper unless I told them that was my name. So this was like an ongoing battle through the whole weekend, and they were really trying to get me to identify myself.
So how did that change after 72 hours when it got more intense? Tell us what happened.
Yeah, so, you know, I think it was around Sunday night, a staff sergeant that was working in the evening there, he just kind of mumbled some words to me like, hang in there. And I just kind of jumped up and I said, sorry, what? And he said, you know, hang in there. And I know through the weekend I was thinking, like, how long could they keep me in this cell for? And I remember reading something somewhere maybe a year ago or so about, you know, a 72-hour limit that they can hold you in custody. Wasn't 100% sure of it, and I never mentioned it to anyone at the facility. On Monday morning around 7:30, 8 o'clock, I was awake, and I was listening to see what may happen around 72 hours, because I was arrested on Friday morning around 7:38, so 72 hours would have been around 7:38 on Monday. And at about 8 o'clock, there was two or three correctional officers outside my cell with the keys, and I heard them say, we have to release them now. It's been 72 hours. And I was awake. I just jumped up off my bench, and I pointed to them, and I said, open the door. And I also noticed a white shirt. That's what they're called in there. She had a golden embroidered crown on her sleeve, and I believe her name was Miss Isles or something similar like that. And she said, no. Do not open this door. We are not releasing this one. And I said, what? And she said, yeah, we're not releasing you. Do you have anything to say? And I was just stood there frozen. And I, after a couple seconds, I said, you have to open this door. You're breaking the law. And she said, there's a warrant out for your arrest. We're not releasing you. I said, you don't even know who I am. You don't even know my name. And she just turned around and walked down the hall. And the CO that was standing there with the keys, he just said, oh, no, and stepped back. And I said, oh, no, what? Open this door. And he just said, I just remember him kind of like trying to avoid the situation and turning around and trying to get out of there. And so, yeah, around the next few hours, they were still trying to get me to come out of the cell and process to go to court that was scheduled for 10:30. Which would have been past the 72 hours, and I refused, obviously. And around hour 80, they sent in a negotiation team. They literally were wearing beige shirts with no other, you know, symbols on them. And they were trying to negotiate for me to come out of the cell and get processed. And I, you know, continued to maintain my recognition as a living man, and that I was not the fictitious entity that was written down on this piece of paper that they kept showing me. And they said, if you do not comply, you will be forcefully removed. And I basically just sat down and waited. And within a matter of 30 minutes, they sent in the brute squad with the pepper spray and the forcefully removing of my clothes and, you know, the shackles. And what they put over me was something called a security gown. And then they basically forced me through a scanner, which I believe is scans for weapons and drugs that people try to transport in the jail. And once they put me through the scanner, they said, you've scanned dirty. And, you know, at the time I was like, I don't even know what they're talking about, because my eyes were still on fire from the pepper spray. And they whisked me away up stairs, down the hall, and to a place called the segregation unit of the jail, where I was placed in, apparently in the coldest and the dampest and the dirtiest cell in the entire jail, with virtually nothing. And I was locked in there.
Paul, 1 minute, just to backtrack a bit, this goon squad that came in, they're called the Institution Crisis Intervention Squad, ISIS. And
ISIS, ISIS.
Okay, so it sounds like they were, did they have clubs? Did they have helmets? Like, what did they look like when they came in?
Yeah, so I had actually seen them remove somebody from a cell right next door to me a few hours prior, and I was observing the negotiation team and the actual ICIT enforcement agents. And there was no, like I said, there was no markings of any kind on them that they were a part of the jail.
No name tags.
Yeah, they were fully covered with gear. They had helmets on with tinted glass. One of them was holding a video camera. One of them was holding a gun, but I was assuming it was like a beanbag gun, but I didn't know. It looked like a, you know, some sort of military style rifle. And then two of them were holding shields, and yeah, they didn't really have any other markings on them at all. And when they were talking, it almost sounded like it was coming through a speaker.
So they've got you basically in a cold 5x10 cell at that point. Tell us what it was like in there. Did they feed you regularly? Did you have a blanket? Just what was it like for you over the following weeks?
Well, when I was first put in there, I, you know, the first thing I noticed was how cold it was, and the entire cell was wet. They stated they sprayed it down with some, I guess, a COVID spray, but there was also water dripping in from the ceiling. I could see that, and there was moisture coming in from other areas. And I was placed on top of a steel bed, no mattress, no nothing on there at all. And I was told to lay down, face down, and hands on top of the head until I heard the door slam behind me. And once it did, you know, I got up. I could barely open my eyes still. The pepper spray was all over my face, my hair. It was very difficult to see for the next hour or two. Once I was able to see, I could see there was a little bit of like a little thinly quilted pad on the floor that was wet. And I put it on top of the steel bed and basically just kind of lay on it and kind of curled up to try to keep warm for the next few hours. And then I think around 1 or 2 o'clock in the morning, I was able to get one of the attentions of a correctional officer and asked for, you know, is there anything else I can have in here because I'm freezing? And he said, well, what do you have? And I said, well, I have this security gown and a little pad. And he said, well, you don't have a blanket? And I said, no. And then he said, oh, I can give you a blanket. So those were the only three items that I was allowed in the cell. Again, no toothbrush, no hygiene products, couldn't take a shower. Couldn't contact anyone with a phone. I was basically cut off from the outside world, and and given, you know, less than humane conditions and things to survive. And
So far, I've listed eight things that qualify as torture under international law and the laws of Canada. And, you know, all of this for a non-appearance. So, like, including the comment, I remember you mentioned to me that they, when you were thirsty, they wouldn't give you water. They said, told you to drink out of the toilet.
Yeah, that was in the first dry cell. When I was first brought in for the weekend, there was no running water whatsoever. And the toilet was working half the time. And you had to ask for water like a dog. And, you know, some correctional officers would ignore you and tell you that there's water in there. And other correctional officers, very few of them, would give you a cup of water. And I never knew when I was going to get my next cup of water, so I did my best to ration, you know, what I had. And but, yeah, when I ended up, at, you know, on Monday when I was taken up to the second segregation cell, and there's reports of my condition, but I was severely dehydrated from the 3 days I spent down in the first cell. And the water in the next cell was running, but the toilet was now not operational. So the conditions, they were pretty brutal.
I do want to, we're already past the half point of the show. So what I do want to do, I want to go back, you know, to talk more about the treatment, but can you give us an overview of exactly what happened and how you got out? Just a summary of how things, went and what it is you think that actually got them to agree to release you.
Okay, well, yeah, the first, you know, from that Monday night on, I found the most difficult thing to deal with while in that cell was the psychological, you know, aspect of it, trying to keep my will up, because that seems like what they were trying to break down after they, you know, took away my dignity. And I just, you know, the things that got me through, you know, spending, you know, 16 hours a day in a cell with nothing was just, you know, thinking and my thoughts and you know, that I want to see my friends and my family again. And, you know, believe it or not, like I was thinking of, you know, stories that I've seen in the past, like, you know, that I don't know if you're familiar with that 28-day, you know, story of this guy that got trapped out in the wilderness and he had to cut off his arm. I was like, you know, if this guy can do that, you know, I can get through this. And you know, knowledge I learned from, you know, Survivor Man, you know, keep my body warm, you know, the vital areas of my body warm, you know, don't sweat, you know, don't start doing push-ups and sit-ups and all that crazy stuff. Just try to preserve yourself as best you can. I don't know how long I'm going to be in here for. I don't know when they're going to give me a toothbrush. I don't know when I'm going to get, you know, anything. So I just had to kind of just preserve the best I could. And, you know, fortunately on the Sunday night, so after being in the cell for about 10 days on the Sunday night, one of the evening sergeants, you know, came to my cell and said he needed the cell for another inmate who had tried to hang himself and they needed to monitor him. And apparently that cell that I was in was a cell that was right across from the, I guess, where their offices. So he had moved me to another cell, A12, and this one had more heat. It was ventilated because the one prior was not ventilated. And I remained in that cell for the remainder of my, you know, confinement. And on Monday, I went for an X-ray. I had told them that after four or five scans that they kept saying that were dirty, I said, you know, I need to go to the hospital. I don't know what you guys are talking about, what's in my stomach. I don't have anything in my stomach. I need to go to the hospital because you're telling me there's something in my stomach. I know there's nothing in my stomach. That's not the reason why I was placed in a dry cell to begin with. And I was taken to the hospital, the Lindsay Hospital, on Monday. And the X-ray came back on Tuesday. And I was cleared. So I was now able to communicate. I was able to use a phone. It really seemed like at that point that something else was going on that I was unaware of on the outside. Yeah.
That's right. Because at that point, after 10 days, we had started a whole campaign. We were calling through to government officials, to the prison. We were putting a lot of heat on, and obviously they were responding to that. But it was also your own behavior that was, you know, you were asking a lot of questions. You had a lot of knowledge of the law that they didn't, and you just refused to mentally buckle. And but although I remember one thing you said to me and when we talked about this was, I believe they were trying to kill me. So do you want to say why you believe that?
Yeah, definitely. After, you know, after that 72-hour mark and that specific incident, you know, I was really concerned for my safety at that point because it just seemed like they were now going above and beyond to keep me in that jail. And I was concerned if, you know, somebody from the high courts or somebody, you know, said, do not release this guy, like break the law. Do whatever you got to do to not let him out. And then they dirty scanned me. And that prevented me from communicating with anybody on the outside. I couldn't use a phone, couldn't write letters, couldn't receive letters. So, you know, they were breaking the law. They were cutting my communication off. And the conditions were so poor. Yeah, I wasn't really sure what their plan was. There was definitely...
Trying to get you to kill yourself.
Sorry?
Trying to get you to kill yourself or collapse mentally, and then they could lock you in an asylum for good, right?
Yeah, there's many things that could have happened. I mean, you know, I could have passed out with the, you know, because there's no air circulation in there at all. They block it off. They, you know, and there's a few times that, you know, I felt like I was, you know, getting dizzy you know, I was just trying to stay conscious and you know, because again, like I don't think anyone would really understand the psychological effects of being locked in a 5x10 concrete, damp, cold cell for 24/7. Like how long, you know, how long do you think you can actually be in there before, you know, you start to, you know, lose your will? It's I didn't know for myself, to be honest with you, but I pushed through and I was planning on pushing through as long as I could. So.
Well, now let's, we've got about 15 minutes left, and I did want to get into some consequences of this. So in a couple of minutes, could you say how you got out of there, like exactly what happened?
So after I was in there on the Monday and the following Monday, there was a court appearance. Again, they wanted to process me before I could go to court. So they wanted to process me as a legal person. Before I could go to those bail hearings. And then I would, on Wednesday, I think it was January 13th, I had been told by a staff sergeant over the weekend that I was going to be put in front of a judge physically on Wednesday. So I was waiting until Wednesday to be put in front of a judge in a court. And when Wednesday came, I was told, no, there's no court dates for you here. Your next court date is January 26th. And I said, what are you talking about? I said, one of the staff sergeants said they were putting me in front of a judge today. No, we have on our computer system here that your next court date is the 26th. So I knew that I was going to have to gut it out now from the 13th to the 26th. And once I was able to communicate the following week, I was able to reach a good friend of mine, Krista, who had set up her cell phone to be able to receive collect calls, which was a real lifesaver, because then she was able to communicate, you know, to all my family and friends and even a lawyer on the outside to file a writ of habeas corpus, which was then filed on the Friday, the following Friday. Finally, 15 days after I had been in there, I was finally able to get a lawyer to file a habeas corpus. Because I wasn't able to do it in there. I wasn't given any resources to do that. And then on the January 26th, that was it wasn't even a bail hearing that was set for January 26th. It was just a court appearance. And the lawyer spoke for me on that on my behalf, and he got them to get a bail hearing on the 28th, and he informed the court that I had a habeas corpus hearing on the 27th. So then... nothing really happened on the 26th. That court date wasn't really anything other than an appearance, I found out. And the entire time I was in the jail, I wasn't given one piece of paperwork, not one court document. I wasn't given the warrant. I wasn't given anything. So,
well,
and the reason
unlawful
why,
confinement.
Exactly. I'd never identified when I went in there, and they said I couldn't give. They couldn't give me any court documents because, they couldn't. They didn't know who I was, right? So I'm like, well, if you don't know right. who I am. You really shouldn't really have me in here anymore, but it just seemed like I was a floater. Like I wasn't processed into the jail and they didn't really know what to do with me, but they didn't want to release me. I was essentially kidnapped and, I was just in this, place that was, operating off of, arbitrary, rules. Everything changed day by day, but, I had a habeas corpus hearing on the Wednesday, the 27th, and it was a complete joke. I mean, the judge couldn't even tell me what law she was acting under on the bench. She didn't even know the jurisdiction of the court.
She pretty much
had her mind up. I believe her name was Justice Spire. I had a friend of mine, Krista, who listened in on the hearing, and it was just unbelievable. Just an absolute clown court, to be honest with you.
Well, then how can they let you out in the bail hearing? Like a day or two later, they then let you out of the bail. About a day or two later, even though she turned you down, they let you out on a bail hearing. Why do you think they did that?
To be honest, I think there was a lot of pressure coming from the outside. I know that when on the Monday when I had the X-ray and the Tuesday when I was able to talk with friends from the outside, that there was starting to be a lot of pressure being put on the jail. I was told from a sergeant in there that there has been a lot of people calling in on the jail, concerned for me and asking about me. And, they said they were really happy that my X-ray turned out to be clean. Like, okay.
Right.
I mean, you knew I was put in the dry cell not for drugs because I was very coherent when I came in. And I was very expressive to everyone that I spoke with. Everyone knew why I was in the dry cell. I mean, they even said right when I came in that I was a road pirate. When the bail hearing came about, it just seemed like they wanted to kind of clean their hands of me and get me out.
Right.
Luckily, I was able to get out and the fight goes on.
So let's spend the last 10 minutes talking about that. At one point when we were talking, you said you definitely felt that you were targeted as a citizen of the Republic, and as such, you're being held, as a rendition of citizen of another nation being held illegally. And that's a crime against humanity under the law. So did you ever raise up with people the issue of the Republic? I mean, obviously it's front and center, even though they're trying to make it look like it isn't, right?
Yeah, well, right when I was arrested, I told the agents that they had no right to search through my wallet or my vehicle without a consent or a warrant, and they were just like, "Well, we'll search through whatever we want." And they went through my wallet and they pulled out the Republic of Citizen card, and one of the officers was questioning me about it, and I said, "Yeah, I am a citizen of the Republic of Canada, and you have no authority to even hold me here right now." And one officer was actually, seemed like she was somewhat interested in learning about it, but I don't know if she was just trying to dig for information. But, they were right from the original arrest. They were well aware that I was a citizen of the Republic of Canada and that they had no authority or jurisdiction over me. So from that point on, right from the original arrest, it was fraudulent. But now from that point on, they were kidnapping a citizen from another nation, which is an act of war. I was a prisoner of war. They had no authority and no jurisdiction to put me into their system in terms of my rights.
And, Paul, it's an attack on any citizen. The Republic when this happens, because they're really saying we can lock up citizens of another jurisdiction, of another nation altogether. So that's why this show is so important, and the need to get this news out and start a whole campaign to expose this, because really it's a threat to all of us. And I want to remind everyone listening that if you are a citizen, part of your pledge says, I will actively establish and defend the Republic and stand in solidarity with and defend all those who take this pledge. So we all have an obligation. You know, that's, Paul, that's why there were over a dozen of us on the phone to the prison and to the government saying, look, our fellow citizens have been held illegally. Let them go now. And it obviously had an impact, right?
Yeah, like I said, I didn't know what was going on the outside. I was, you know, obviously given limited information. But, you know, through a friend of mine, Krista, she was able to relay, you know, some of the things that were going on. And, you know, it was a very uncomfortable situation because they were even breaking their own laws and breaking, you know, the rule of law in their own nation to hold me there. And then, you know, from the violent arrest to the, you know, forcible confinement and torture, and basically what they seemed to be trying to do was, you're going to stay in this jail until you identify as a citizen of our nation. And a citizen of their nation is not even identified in law as a human being. And I don't know if I could touch on that very briefly, but under the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 6, it says, everyone has the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law. This is then expressed in the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights under Article 16, which states, again, everyone shall have the right to recognition everywhere as a person before the law, and then is expressed in the Canadian Charter under Section 7, as everyone has the right to liberty. So there's two recognitions in law, which is everyone and person, and each recognition has a different set of rights and freedoms. And as a human being, not taking recognition as a citizen or a legal person, you know, we have the right to freedom of association. We have the right to take a pledge to whatever nation we feel we want to take a pledge to. So I was not even under the jurisdiction of Crown authority for quite some time now, and the police, the Durham Regional Police, their ignorance of the law has now basically been brought out into the open. They literally have no idea what they're doing. They are getting printouts from these black robe judges, and they are just tyrannically going out and doing whatever these judges want them to do. They're not even aware of their own actions, which is extremely scary. Yeah.
Ignorance of the law is no defense in court. It doesn't matter if they're ignorant of the law. Objectively, they're committing a war crime by attacking a citizen of another nation. You are and were a prisoner of war. And I doubt if they're going to touch again because of the heat that's being created around all this now. Right? They knew they had a lot more to lose than you do. And they've been shown up. I mean, this. You know what's really amazing, Paul, by your story? The nature of the society is shown up right there. It's a criminal prison country, right? And they can ignore their own rules and laws whenever they like. So let's use the last... We've only got 5 minutes left here, and I do want you to come back, Paul, so we can get into this more. But come back on next week if you're free. But talk a little bit about what you want to do now, how you think you want to carry this campaign forward in a way that's going to build up our republic and our liberties and make sure this stuff doesn't keep happening.
Yeah, I mean, I went through a roller coaster of emotions when I was, you know, forcefully confined. And, you know, I really wasn't sure, you know, where things were going to go once I got out, if I got out. You know, it's a tough one to run away from. It's still something that is in front of me in my life, and I'm just going to have to continue to do what feels right and continue to fight in any way I can. It seemed like the only way they could arrest me was in a vehicle using a photo on my driver's license, so I think it may be apparent that that might be the first thing to go. Let's see how they're going to arrest me again. Without a driver's license. But, you know, there's a couple of things that, you know, I still have some things up my sleeve that I haven't used yet. I'm not going to disclose that, obviously, on here tonight. They're going to have some issues coming their way real soon, and big ones.
Now, one of the things, it's been suggested by a number of people that we convene a grand jury investigation into this under the jurisdiction of the Republic in Ontario. And that way we can start gathering the evidence and make a whole case for the whole public about this. This is a political trial. You're a political prisoner and prisoner of war. And it's a great tool to educate people and to broaden the impact we're having, Paul. So I really would like to have you on again in the future to talk about some ideas about how we go about that.
Yeah, there's a lot to talk about. You know, I try to condense, you know, as best I could, but I could, you know, speak for hours and hours about this stuff.
I know. You did a brilliant job. I know it's a hard thing to do to summarize, especially the whole emotional wear and tear you've gone through. And, you know, I just want to honor you for your courage and strength, and it's going to pay off. You've inspired a hell of a lot of people, and even more in the future when they learn about this. Any final words before we sign off?
I want to leave it lightheartedly that, you know, throughout this experience, you know, I did experience, you know, some humanity from, you know, some of the employees that work there. I know it's a very difficult job, and they didn't know why I was in there, and you know, but, you know, there are some good people working in law enforcement and in the correctional facility that I was in. And I don't want to, you know, I can't go into depth now about, you know, those experiences, but, you know, it does lead me to believe that there is a light at the end of the at the end of the road. I think people just need to wake up more to what's going on. And you know, we even in Canada, where we're taught that we're free, people should really start to investigate that more, because I think knowledge and wisdom is the way out of this. So
exactly. And if you're free next week, we'll have you back on and have others on to talk about this whole broader issue of the kind of society we're in and the kind of society we want to create as an alternative. So, Paul Kalibas from Ontario, thank you so much, brother.
Yeah, no problem. And it's Paul of the Kaliba family, Kevin.
I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. Paul of the Kaliba family.
Thanks
thank
again,
you, Paul.
All right.
We'll talk next week.
Okay. Bye.
And for the last couple of minutes, just a number of the announcements I was going to share earlier. First of all, the National Council of the Republic is issuing a statement about what happened, because as Paul touched on, this is an act of war against any citizen in the Republic. And it's called an illegal rendition, where you're kidnapping citizens from another nation and bringing them forcibly into your jurisdiction to be tortured, like what the CIA did in the rendition flight after 9/11 and everything. Exactly the same thing. That's what just happened to Paul of the Kaliba clan. Now, we are asking people to become part of that. If you want more information, write to Republic National Council at protonmail.com. They're issuing, in consultation with Paul, they'll be issuing a public statement soon about all of this. And we'll be starting a whole campaign, because folks and many of the citizens listening in right now, this is an amazing opportunity to teach people about the need for the Republic and the frailty of so-called laws in Canada, how they're thrown out in an instant because of the crown, so-called crown power to ignore anything. The supremacy of the crown is the ultimate law, as we've seen time and again. And human rights has no weight in practice when push comes to shove in this system. The other thing I want to flag for people as well is, remember that we are having our National Convention of the Republic to create a constitution to establish the whole framework for the Republic, the new society growing up inside the shell of the old. If you like, take out citizenship, you can make amendments to that constitution. Again, write to Republic National Council at protonmail.com. Follow our work, Republic of Kanata, K-A-N-A-T-A, republicofkanata.ca, and murderbydecree.com. And we're going to close now with one of our theme songs, which is Farewell to the Crown. And we hope you all come back next week to continue this discussion with Paul and a lot of the issues that have come out from that, which we didn't have time to get into today. Carry it on. Stay strong. Stay clear. Thank you.